Welcome to the Make an Impact podcast. And today I'm joined by Rhonda from Wellington Counselling. I'm super excited about talking to Rhonda because she has an amazing approach to counselling. And I can't wait for you to meet her in a few moments.
So I'm here. Hello.
Hello, Rhonda. Welcome. So, Rhonda,
you.
tell the people listening and watching a little bit about yourself.
So I'm currently sitting in my very large she shed, as my children refer it to. So I have a lovely big shed in my garden, which is my kind of office. And it gives me that sort of separation from the house, which is quite important. Over these last few years, I've ended up like lots of people working more from home. So I choose to work in a very large shed, and it's very comfortable and very heated. So that's where I am at the moment.
It sounds perfect. I need one of those in my garden. Definitely. So, tell us a little bit about Wellington Counselling, how you got started, what the journey's been like so far.
So it's been really fascinating, actually. I suppose I'm kind of sitting here as somebody who's, a 61-year-old woman who's had a number of different careers, and I'm looking at the way in which those careers have just, beautifully blended and created this skill set within me, I think, as well as kind of passion to do the things that I love to do. So in the past, I've been a gender studies lecturer, and I had a sort of sense in my early 20s of lots of different kinds of injustices that were going on in the world, starting with my own sob story, which was that I had very good A levels and couldn't get a job, and the 80s was a time of very high unemployment and all sorts of difficult political circumstances in the UK. So I feel like my age is perfect in that I kind of, I merged into a university course and then career that enabled me to talk passionately about the things that really mattered to me. And it used to be the politics of race and gender, and then it became the politics of gender. And I ended up, as I said, specialising as a gender studies lecturer, primarily at Exeter University. And that's that sense of injustice for me just rolled over into other tranches of my own life as a single parent. And I think that what I understood really cogently was that we all suffer enormously, and actually, unless you're in a sort of semi-privileged position, both to have the money to pay for therapy and you know about the benefits of therapy, you wouldn't have it. So Wellington Counselling, when I set it up formally 5 years ago, was very much about a project to address and redress these inequalities of access to good mental health provision for anyone who needs it, irrespective of their ability to pay for it. And that's sort of where I am now, is just sort of looking back at that amalgamation of my skill set that's enabled me to apply myself to training to be a therapist, setting up Wellington Counselling within a CIC structure, learning about business. I've had a lot of fantastic support from pro bono support from different organisations that enabled me to hone up some business skills, because I didn't have them. I just had this idea about what I wanted to do, and have worked really hard to bring that into effect. Yeah. We don't
Wow.
do this for the money.
Well, you might do, but you also do it for the love.
Very much for the love, yeah.
Yeah. So it sounds like an interesting journey. I mean, you talked there about learning about the business side of running Wellington Counselling. What made you want to set up your own counselling business as opposed to just joining an existing one?
So is that this a little bit like the gap, isn't it? It's like finding the gap. As it was, my professional background had enabled me to work as a therapist in a secondary school as their school counsellor, and also in primary schools. And I became aware of what the NHS services may have had to offer. But that actually, again, it comes back to what I was saying earlier on, is that there's lots of people in private practice who can be there to help your child or your family member or yourself. But there isn't, we don't have a national mental health service. And I like the idea of there being a kind of local service that is there for everybody who needs it, irrespective of their ability to pay. So it just became a sort of no-brainer to some extent. I needed to set up something that was independent, and that gave anybody who needed the opportunity to have therapy. And intermingled with that, I was speaking with Vernon earlier on, your interviewer, about actually how the absolute gift for me was just this sort of moment in time when I was on a stage in a primary school after there'd been a school performance, and the local Reverend Tim Trina approached me and said, "Well, so we know there's all of these, you know, problems in our community. What can we do about them?" And I said, "Well, we need we need a community counselling centre."
And
Yeah.
that's how it happened.
And that's how it happened, because, you know, he put me in touch with some other people that had had, you know, equally had thought that it would be a good idea for there to be something like that. And various other people then came together, and I had a lot of support from the town council, and I still do. So it just sort of happened, it just sort of done it by itself to some degree. But I also know that what really drives it is that everybody who works at Wellington Counselling adheres to and applauds the values. You know, we're very value driven, both personally and professionally as counsellors. So it's kind of win-win, I think. That's how I like to think of it.
It sounds like an idyllic place to work, although I'm not sure that I'd be a very good counsellor.
You have very fine listening skills. It's a good place to start.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. We know you've got started. It's very much driven by your values. So what does that look like in terms of delivery? How does community counselling feel different to if I went and paid for a counselling service?
I think that actually what we offer as a community interest company is a counselling service that is akin to the service that you would get if you went to see a private practitioner. So, you know, the whole process is geared to be very relational. So whilst our clients make a referral onto our via our website, I am the person that they speak to do the assessment with. And that process is the same as I would use if I were seeing a client in my own private practice. So it's very relational. It's very compassionate. It's about easing the client into a place where they know that they're seen and heard by me. But also, I think that they're not going to be kept waiting. They're not going to be kept waiting. And that actually the money isn't an obstacle. So a lot of people are incredibly vulnerable when they approach a therapist for counselling, and I want to make sure that they feel really safe at every step of the way, actually, with us. And that's really key. And I think counsellors are like that. That's what we're like. What's interesting is how you actually import that sort of paradigm from the counselling world into a business that has to be, well, it's not for profit, but we. You know, we have to make business sense. But there's nothing stopping me being that relational based person when I'm speaking to our clients or prospective clients. And I think that makes a big difference because, as I said, it's like a private service, but it's within a community interest company model.
Yeah, that sounds again, it just sounds really evident that the values are coming through in terms of how you work and approach with all of your clients that you work with. So, I suppose one of the questions that I'm quite curious is about, although I know you mentioned that you felt that everyone should have access to therapy regardless of their income. Did you anticipate or how much demand did you expect there to be? And have you seen that actually there's a lot more people that need therapy than and counseling you thought, or is it what you already anticipated?
But it's such a tasty question because I suppose it's like we, you know, I suspect that we just see, you know, we're just offering a drop in the ocean because so many people are waiting for help. And I don't have any, I don't have current access to what the waiting lists are like for CAMHS. For example, if you have a child or a young person who needs that specialist level of help, I don't know what the waiting lists are like for talking therapies across the county, sorry, across the country, but I know that we're looking at a 9-month waiting list in Somerset. So immediately what happens is that when people go to their GPs, if they live in Wellington, they'll be fortunate enough that their MP, sorry, their GP will say, so yeah, so there's a 9-month waiting list for talking therapies, but here, get in touch with Wellington Counselling. And we'll see them within days, if not a week. So it's very hard to know what the demand is. It's really, really hard to know what the demand is. But what we are seeing is that although there isn't much discussion about, you know, the pandemic or post-pandemic conditions, and the new, you know, the new lot of sorry, I can't remember the word for it, contain well, the word's completely gone, variant of COVID. Sorry, got my words back. There's a lot of COVID in the community. There are a lot of adults who have children who are school refusing because they develop quite high levels of social anxiety during lockdowns and haven't gone back to school, and that has a knock-on effect on their family's ability to go to work, etc. So we still are noticing a very high demand for counselling around social anxiety amongst children and young people and adults. And then on top of that, you've got the cost of living crisis and all the other things that happen, which we're kind of aware of as a nation, which you can see as these kind of externalities. But it's how those externalities then impact on a person's internal world. And of course, what counselling is primarily about is helping people with their internal world and learning to understand themselves better. But then that internal world is being impacted on by so many externalities now. And there's a lot of fear in the community. And there's a lot of problems to do with shortages of money for schools. You know. So the problems are always going to be there. A really big challenge for any organisation such as ours, and even the NHS is to know what that demand might be like and to manage that demand.
It definitely still seeing with a lot of the clients that we work with that the impact of COVID and the lockdowns is still coming through, and you know some people it's not over for people. In fact, some people are only realizing now the stress and pressure that they were under at that time. So yeah, I can imagine that counseling and therapy and anything like that is going to be in huge demand for a long time to come. So, how do you plan to cope with all this increasing demand?
So we've recently taken on some premises in Bridgwater so that we can open up in Bridgwater because while I set up Wellington Counselling 5 years ago specifically for Wellington, across time word has spread and certainly going online during lockdowns helped us reach people in farther outside, you know, further away from Wellington. So we're actually able to support anybody online throughout the whole of Somerset and in Devon, in fact. And what I do is I'm looking all the time at the demand for counselling and then looking at my team, which is a blend of fully qualified counsellors and trainee counsellors. So I always kind of have a team of about between 12 and 14 counsellors. All of them are already self-employed, those that are fully qualified. And it's about looking at when we have our team meetings, looking about whether any of those counsellors have got the capacity to take on more Wellington counselling clients. I have to say, I wouldn't say it's a queue of people wanting to join us, but I have a lot of people who want to join us because the way in which we work, not just in terms of how we work with our clients, but also the sort of organisational culture of Wellington is very favoured by the existing team of counsellors, and they all talk about what it's like to work at Wellington. So I'm hopeful that the sort of supply and demand model, which is loosely what I'm looking at and we're discussing, can continue. And I've been very lucky that my skill set from being an academic's helped me make successful funding applications, because of course what we're really primarily looking at is a high percentage of our clients are people who wouldn't otherwise be able to afford counselling. So grant dependency also fuels that ability to meet that need.
Do you think that it will always be that you're dependent on grants, or do you imagine at some point you'll be part of the healthcare system in that you'll be a paid referral mechanism?
So I suppose that there's something to be said about our independence, and I think that the KIC model really supports being an independent organisation in the way that we are. I think it's to be remembered that the NHS has a particular approach to managing low to moderate mental health difficulties, which is based on cognitive behavioural therapy approaches, and it's tried and tested, and it's NICE approved. The risk for us is through any kind of commissioning route is that there may be an insistence that we adhere to that model. That model is often time restricted. So it's not uncommon for people to be offered 6 to 8 sessions of CBT, which could be enough for some people, but it may not be the right approach for others, and it may be not be the right amount of time. And I think we're fortunate that we are able to offer a framework of 12 sessions to our clients. It's 12 weeks worth of therapy, but we often extend that because there's a need to extend it. So I think our dependency on grants is always going to be there. I'd like us to be 60% dependent on grants and 40% dependent on traded income. That's my overall objective, because I think that way we can meet our sort of social mission. And I don't want to feel that as a sort of founding director, if you like, that there's anything wrong with that approach. There is definitely money in circulation, but whether there's a philanthropist out there who wants to give a counselling organisation like myself and the other ones a huge dollop of money, this is the reality, isn't it? And I think it's part of an unspoken understanding that the charitable and voluntary sector does a lot of work that our government doesn't apply money to.
Yeah, definitely. I the reason I asked you that because I just wanted to get your perspective on being part of the NHS eventually out of curiosity. So you mentioned there about being able to fulfill your social mission and your impact. What do you think or what have you seen that you've achieved so far in terms of impact with the people that you've supported?
So I suppose in a very generalized sense, we are thought of as the go-to counselling service in Wellington. So I mentioned, that some GPs make referrals to us. We have parent family support advisors, the PCSO, the police. Actually, CAMHS refer back to us, so we are established in the in that a kind of community of professionals are aware that we are there, and I think that's really significant because that alleviates some of them of the pressure that they are under. I think it can be more dispiriting, for example, for a GP to be aware that there's a 9-month waiting list for his or her patient. For that GP to be able to say, go and see Wellington Counselling and know that they are going to be seen, has got to be very relieving professionally for that practitioner, as it is for the other practitioners that refer into us. What I've noticed is when we're getting our referrals in, we ask people where they've heard about us. It's word of mouth and family and friends. And for me, that's the most special bit of this, is that having gone through some marketing exercises and various advertising campaigns, we can completely rely now on word of mouth for more clients to come our way because we're trusted. And that says a lot, I think, about the impact that we're having on a local level. And my greater ambition would be to see more of Wellington counselling being rolled out elsewhere in the county and across the country, really, because there's no reason why it couldn't happen.
No, definitely not.
No.
Providing you've got the money.
Well, it's having the money and the team, but I think, as I said, as alluded to this before, it's like the paradigm within which councillors work within means that there's such a lot of goodwill and care there and hope that I'm pretty sure that other people could do this too.
I would imagine there's a lot of people that would want to do this. So do you see it as fixing a broken system?
Oh, gosh. I don't think the system of actually addressing the nation's mental health has ever been formally constituted.
Is that full stop, the end of the
That is a
answer?
bit of a full stop, isn't it? I think it's really interesting that actually we lean on the national health system and have been doing since it was set up after the Second World War to is our go-to place. Nobody would ever have imagined that people would be going to their GP because of mental health problems or emotional well-being problems, but that's what we do. And we're more aware of the way in which physical illness can be treated, and there's an expectation that that mental health can be treated as an illness in the same sort of way. But there is not any sort of, there isn't any money in the NHS to meet all of the needs that we have as a nation. And our needs are very complex as human beings, and there's a huge amount of suffering that's going on. And I haven't seen any political party really take this challenge on. I think that the Welsh and the Scottish assemblies have done a phenomenal job at making sure that there are councillors in every school in Wales and in Scotland, but we haven't got that same pledge in this bit, England. We don't have that.
England's always different.
It is always different, but I suppose it can be said to be a measure of how compassionate a nation is that it actually puts more money into not just looking after the mental health of people, but making sure that the circumstances that create the problems are not there. Living in poverty causes huge emotional and psychological stresses on an individual. That's going to manifest itself in some sort of way. Am I as an individual responsible for the management of this economy? No, I'm not, but I can feel it. And who's going to help me? Well, that's the question, isn't it? Is who can people turn to when they're in need like that? Because it's not always the family that can help. There's something quite extraordinary about sitting with a complete stranger to start with, to whom you can tell your story and start to feel better about yourself.
You mentioned in there a few times about working with young children and young people that have had social anxiety as a consequence of the lockdowns. Are you seeing more young people coming through and needing support, or is that it's just they're now coming much more with social anxiety as opposed to other issues?
It's been a bit of a continuum. I would say that what we had during the first, going back to March, April, May 2020, is a trickle of adults and parents really struggling with needing to be at home and do their jobs and do the education of their children, all those sorts of things too. There then being children refusing to go back to school once schools opened up and parents struggling with that. This hasn't changed in these last 3 years, 3.5 years. It's not changing. What's coming out now is a larger number of secondary school children who have tried to go back to school and have failed at that for lots of different reasons, and that they are at home not being educated, not having any social life, and not getting any kind of help. And the parents really struggling with that, because we haven't created an infrastructure that's supportive of those sorts of scenarios. Because in a sense, going back to what I said earlier on, there aren't any discussions. There haven't been any discussions on the news about how we're managing the new variant and the impact that's had on people now. And we're not talking about the ongoing march of problems that arose from the first couple of lockdowns we had.
It feels almost a lot of doom and gloom and like a sense that there's much more to come for people in terms of challenges.
I think there are, and various national organisations have highlighted this. It's not kept as a secret. It's just, where is the support? Where is the money to support schools and parents get their children back into schools? And that's the doom and gloom, I suppose, is that is the underinvestment in all of these statutory services over the last 13 years. And we're all seeing the consequence of that, from concrete rot to lack of teachers and classroom assistants. So it's a sizable problem, and it's not one that has a, there's not a one answer to this. There has to be whole scale investment in public life, and as I said, more compassionate government would go a long way right now.
Yeah, they need some counselling skills. I
Yes.
think that might help them to start with if they listened a little bit.
I suppose there's always this thing, isn't there, about depth, whether you can empathize. And I often think it'd be quite interesting for they did this thing years ago, didn't they, where MPs had a day sort of swapping out with somebody who worked in a coal mine or as a classroom assistant. And I think it'd be quite good to see a bit more of that going on, so that they can empathize more.
Yeah,
Yeah.
sounds like a good idea. As long
New
as you
Kid
don't
Me program.
please don't send me down a coal mine. what's the future for Wellington Counselling?
Well, it has a future, and I think that I'm encouraged by the number of people who've said to me, so if your kick's 5 years old, you're here to stay. I've never had any doubts about our longevity, really, or our sustainability, because we all believe in what we're doing, and I think that shines through. What I would like to, and it's part of my business planning for the next couple of years, is that I want to have a high street community wellbeing centre. So it's a walk-in centre, so that anybody that needs help with their emotional health and wellbeing can step in, and we can help them. But that would also It's also about accessibility. Unfortunately, whilst we have two counselling rooms, they're up two flights of stairs. So we often have to offer Zoom to people who have got mobility issues, or it's just inaccessible. So yeah, we need a high street premises, and that means a lot to me, because I think there's a lot of talk about having community hubs, which used to be also called children's centres once upon a time. And those things have disappeared from this county. And community hubs are coming back slowly, but I think there's something about reducing the stigma around mental health and well-being, that actually, you walk into the I don't I do that personally, but people walk into the hairdressers and the nail bars and the tattoo parlors and all these places on the high street, and I want to say, well, why haven't you got a counselling shop on the high street? Because people need help, and it's how to widen access. And I think having a high street presence would really do that.
That sounds amazing. You mentioned in there about stigma around mental health issues. Do you still think that that's a big issue, or have you seen that there's a reduction in stigma?
think it's a hard one to answer with such sort of definitive yes or no answers. I think it's changing. More and more people are admitting to having difficulties, whether emotional or mental health issues. And I think that the more people that speak up about the fact that they've struggled, the easier it makes it for other people to go, yeah, I've had a problem there too. So it's permission giving. And I think it's like a wave in that respect. You know, if you get one rugby player admitting to the fact that they're really struggling with their self-worth, that enables another person or anybody to go, yeah, I'm struggling too. So it's very permission giving when you start opening up conversations with people about their emotional well-being and mental health. It much so that's what Ruby Wax did brilliantly, didn't she? She did that, you know, and it's vital that that happens. There's still a problem around, you know, I don't even know if it's a sort of a British stiff upper lip thing, which is about how it's not okay to show how you feel, that you have to hide it. And that's still very obvious in some populations. And I don't want to make sweeping generalizations by pointing out which populations those are. But what I'm hopeful of is that more of us can show that it's hard work being a human being, and feeling is not always easy, and it sometimes feels easier to cut out lots of feelings than maybe just have a lot of drama. But actually, what we have to do as human beings is just accept our human beingness and feel a whole range of emotions and manage them, not want to dismiss them or get rid of them. And that's a very large educational project in itself, really. And I think that there's a lot that we can do to just share being real that makes the difference, actually. And then it's not about stigma, is it? It's just about, well, what's it like being human today?
Yeah,
Yeah.
I think that reminds me of this idea that, you know, we don't wake up and we say, right, tick a box, I've got my mental health sorted today. We're on a spectrum, aren't we? And some days it's better than others, and we need to accept that it is what it is, rather than saying, well, if my mental health doesn't look perfect in terms of what someone else would describe as perfect mental health, then there's something wrong with me.
Yeah, and of course, what you're touching upon then is a very grave risk that people will go onto the internet and put in what they believe to be their symptoms and have a diagnosis and talk them into not themselves sometimes into being in a very wobbly place. But we're not really encouraged to witness ourselves being human. There are these kind of societal pressures on us to be something that we can't be. You know, our brains, you know, in terms of the field of neuroscience, we know that our brains are not designed to be continuously happy, and yet that's what we keep trying to pursue. And our brains can't do that. Our brains get overwhelmed with that pursuit of happiness. So we have to come back to being real, and isn't always comfortable. But I really think that there's a lot that schools could do around actually encouraging and teaching people how to know themselves. So we learn a lot about history and geography and sciences and art. You know, we learn lots and lots of things, but the journey into ourselves isn't necessarily something we're encouraged to pursue or believe in. But it's the most vital thing we can do is to know ourselves.
Definitely, definitely. Well, Rhonda, it's been really, really good talking to you today. Is there anything else that you want to share before we finish up?
Yeah, I think what I'd like to leave you with is just how important it is that anyone that's listening to this gets into the habit of checking out that they're being kind to themselves, both in what they think about themselves and what they're doing with themselves, because we all need to be kinder to ourselves, genuinely kinder to ourselves, and then spread the kindness, because that makes for a much more peaceable environment to be in. So have kind families, kind schools, kind communities, and see the difference it makes.
Fabulous. Well, a lovely way to end today's podcast episode. So thank you very much for joining me, Rhonda. It's been lovely speaking
Oh,
to you.
it's been just.
I hope you enjoyed that episode of the podcast with Rhonda Lovell from Wellington Counselling. Really fascinating to get her insights around mental health and the needs within the community. If you're new to the podcast, I'm Heidi Fisher. I'm an impact measurement specialist. I run Make an Impact, which is a social enterprise. We work with the public sector, social enterprises, and charities to help them to better measure, communicate, and report the impact they have. Please do get in touch if you need help with anything, and I look forward to seeing you on the next episode of the podcast.